How can we learn to flourish because of who we are, not in spite of it? What is the sensory experience of the world for people with autism and ADHD? How can music help heal trauma and foster identity?
Mattia Murray is an interdisciplinary composer whose work centers around themes of perception, body, sensation, trauma, and resilience. Their scores for critically acclaimed films have been played in 13 countries. Their poems have been featured in Boston City Hall as part of the Mayor's Poetry Program, Guerrilla Opera, and ARC Poetry Magazine. Mattia composes and performs on violin, voice, and piano, and has taught music for over 20 years. They've received a Master's of Music in Composition at New England Conservatory and a Bachelor's of Music from St. Olaf College. They also are an AUDHD coach and help other neurodivergent folks heal and find their creative flow in their course, Love Your Brain.
Mattia Murray, welcome to the creative process.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
So you say that creative outlets became your refuge, allowing you to escape the confines of the evangelical household that you grew up in and connect you with your body. But at the time when you were finding your way, well, I guess music has always been part of your life, but you didn't know at that time that this connection would become your own path to healing.
Yeah, absolutely. Jumping right in with that. The arts in general, I feel like, were the thing that made sense to me as a kid and that I could really link into. I was hyperlexic. I'm autistic. I didn't know that I was autistic or ADHD as a kid. So having that experience of just being different than other people, and then also growing up in poverty and having abusive parents, which again is like wrapped in with poverty, like I have a lot of compassion for my parents. And at the same time, maybe they shouldn't have had seven kids. They couldn't afford it. So music was a big part of my life. And because my parents were both musicians, they literally cared more about music education than food. I had violin lessons starting at a very young age. My dad was trading English lessons to someone who had just emigrated for violin lessons for me. So I had this, and then my dad taught me piano. So I had this very musical space, but it was also this religious space. So it was very much like the music is for God. There are some kinds of music that are better than others. And funnily enough, my dad actually doesn't like my music that I write, my compositions, because he likes kind of more traditional classical music. So as far as the healing side of that, what I think music allowed me to do was process a lot of things, not verbally, and just have these big cathartic, like when I was in choir, I would just cry sometimes during performances, which I look back and I'm like, oh, wow, kind of be surprised that the conductor didn't check in and try to make me not do that because it was pretty obvious. But, you know, I was just having these big processing experiences in my body. And I feel like that's one of the things that music allowed me to do. And then in having a creative outlet where I could just lose myself and be super, super invested and involved in it and get into flow states and stuff, that's actually one of the most regulating things for autistic nervous systems, being able to do that. So I feel like it helped me in a wide variety of ways.
But it's wonderful. I mean, I guess you might not even exactly know. So I understand that you're not in regular contact with your parents.
Correct. Yeah.
So they may have to different degrees that you don't know, like they haven't perhaps been diagnosed.
I mean, my dad's definitely autistic and ADHD. And that my parents talked about ADD a lot, actually, when I was a kid, because they both have a lot of traits. And it's like, again, it's pretty obvious. I feel like if you're constantly losing, you were constantly getting locked out of the house because they would lose their keys and stuff like that. And then my dad's family has a lot of autistic folks in it. That generation, like we're just starting to unpack all of there's still a lot of negative stereotypes and people just not understanding what it looks like outside of one very particular type of presentation. And for my parents, I have a lot of for how hard it was to try to do what they were doing, again, like in poverty and with their own undiagnosed and untreated trauma as well. So all of that together, like this generational stuff, I don't know, it's really hard to address.
And I mean, it would indicate, like you're saying, with that undiagnosed or fairly evident to you, but maybe not you haven't had that full conversation because it's hard, that prioritizing music over food would indicate that music is medicine. It's not, this is more important than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. That I was definitely the approach. And my dad was in the church doing music. So that was part of that just background. And I know there are a lot of performers who have a church music background because you're performing every week from a very young age. So I just had all this comfort basically performing, improvising, and sight reading. And there were downsides, but I try to, in some ways, focus on the positives at this point now that I've done a lot of my own therapeutic work. And I do feel like that church music background gave me a lot of opportunities to just like become comfortable performing and trying things. And I think especially the improv side of it, I might not have developed that otherwise. I would have just probably been on the classical route.
Yeah, so you're a composer, of course, and you write the written element, of course, and you have your podcast as well. So you're also a healer. And so you do a lot of things. And I'm wondering, just it's interesting that when one is given a gift to passed on from your parents, and then you also it's blended with the kind of trauma or things that weren't quite explained, you can't separate them. As you say, they're entwined. You don't want to throw out all those elements and then you understand there were perhaps parts. And I don't mean to just focus on this, but I think it's interesting that there were just parts that weren't an ideal childhood, if that even exists in this world. But we have an idea of the kind of love and care that we would have wanted. I was moved because I was listening to different interviews you've done, and you talked about like you were a good child, like a reminder to yourself that you were a good child, because sometimes you might have been, when you were growing up, told, oh, you were difficult or something like this. So the child kind of takes the responsibility on themselves. Could you just discuss that? Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that was a moment I had with my therapist where I said something along the lines of I was just a really difficult child or a bad child or something like that. And I think I said probably difficult, not bad, but she was just like, do you think it's possible that you were fine and your parents just didn't know how to handle you? And I was like, oh, that's why we go to therapy. But yeah, that has really reshaped the way that I've thought about myself. And again, with kind of that reprocessing, I'm not at all a toxic positivity type person. I think it's really important to recognize the duality and the ups and downs of what happens. And that I think bad things that happen, especially to kids, it's like, no, that shouldn't have happened. I'm not in the, oh, there's, you know, the silver lining. And at the same time, I think part of what came out of that for me is that I have this compassion and this understanding for a wide variety of life experiences that has kept me, I guess, humble, but like connected to reality. And something I think about a lot is that the classical music world is incredibly elitist and still quite sexist, non-binary, they, them pronouns. The elitism in particular, I didn't really get at, because that's another autistic trait, is not really attaching or understanding hierarchy. So I was thinking as I'm, you know, applying to things, applying to grants and opportunities, it's great to mention that I grew up poor. It's cool that I managed to still build a career in this space where most people have family wealth, basically. Then I was literally not getting anything I was applying for until I started removing. And I was like, oh, they don't actually want to know that. They want to know that in retrospect, like once your career is already bigger. But as far as actually moving forward in the classical music world, that classism is actually really obvious and present. So I started going down that rabbit hole, but it's really, I think about that a lot when I reflect on how my childhood made me who I am, because I'm very proud of that. And at the same time, if I talk about it a lot, people are like, oh, why are you talking about that? And just again, in that little sliver of the classical music world, which I know is still not the whole world.
That's so interesting. It's important to say that, because we don't, you know, we don't talk about money, but all these things that you're, so there's all these rules that you don't realize. And I think that as a neurodivergent person as well, you're always having to analyze things. What everyone else seems to know, you have to make note of that as well. But I didn't realize that unwritten rule about classical music, that it's in between the lines that you just have to navigate. So how did you begin to understand the rules of society? I mean, that sounds weird, but like, the rules are changing all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think in that particular example, it really was, I'm not exaggerating, I literally had not gotten a single grant or won anything until I started reshaping the way I was talking about my work. And then also the first bigger award that I won was anonymously judged. So they weren't looking at my whole resume. And then that kind of catapulted things. Just on that front, part of what I realized was, oh, okay, I do, like how I present myself matters, how I talk about myself matters. One of the things that I noticed worked well in just a lot of institutional settings is focusing on the positive and sort of being more upbeat, which I can do. It's just as much masking as anything else, you know. It doesn't feel that weird, but I realized that was one of the things that works in a lot of professional settings, is just sort of like not saying anything too intense or dark or about my past, because my life was so tough up until about age, you know, 23, 24, that I can't really talk about much that happened in any detail without mentioning things that are pretty intense. So I just don't talk about it in a lot of settings. So that was kind of one of the things I realized. And then honestly, I mean, in terms of learning how society works, I've had friends and people I've dated who just like sit me down and they're like, you keep doing this thing and you can't keep saying that. Like, you can't keep doing that at a party. Like, that's not cool. And, you know, that's not necessarily the ideal way, but I think that is how a lot of us, autistic folks in particular, learn is basically just people not liking what we're doing and saying something about it. And then I read a lot of books about body language and communication. Like, I wanted to understand communication. So I tried. But I think that that direct human element of a person saying, like, here's why this is not a cool thing to say, or like, you know, this is why people don't want to hear this story, et cetera. Like, that was probably a lot of what I got out of it.
And so we just mentioned 24, 25, and that's when you came out?
That's when I stopped having so much food insecurity. I think about that a lot, too, like the moments where like poverty is traumatizing and it's re-traumatizing. So having more stability. And in this case, going to my master's program, from there on, I just had more stability, basically. It cut my anxiety by so much, not having housing insecurity for more of that time. There was a period of time where I was moving about every 6 months, just because I couldn't afford anywhere that I was, like, right soon before that, between like undergrad and that period. So yeah, I don't know. That's not really about like the creative stuff, but it's funny. And thinking about like the broad creative process, part of the reason I've had these periods of time where I write a whole bunch in a short amount of time is because I have the stability and the space to do so. I'm just like, great, I'll just write a whole bunch. And I would love it if my life had been a little bit more steady in terms of support for composition, but it's tough to build that if you don't have essentially generational wealth or some other kind of like societal support around that.
It's so interesting because people who haven't had those kind of traumas or financial insecurity or not having that kind of support system can kind of romanticize trauma. Yeah, if it's something that you're not sure, you can't always flourish under trauma. So you spoke about having these periods where you could be creative. Maybe we should introduce a piece of music from that period, but I'm not sure which that would be. You can let me know.
Yeah, well, one, obviously, during grad school, that was what I was doing. So I wrote quite a bit in that period of time because that was my main focus. And one of my favorite, I mean, my favorite piece I've written from that period is Smackety Bang. Great title. Two piano, two percussion. And that was an honors ensemble at New England Conservatory where I got my master's, performed that. So they did such a great job. The recording is so good. And I would have liked the piece anyway, but they just nailed it. And I feel like when you write, because it's kind of weird music, it's rhythmically very complex. And if it wasn't performed well, I might look back and go, oh, I tried something. That's how some things feel. But then when you get that really great performance and they do it exactly the way I had it in mind, because I got to work with them as well, that really stands out to me as I had an idea, it worked. I like the way the piece sounds. And then also it did what I wanted it to do emotionally, even though, again, I know not everybody likes contemporary classical music, but that's probably my favorite piece.
I think it's rare when you have an idea and it comes out exactly like there's a path of arriving at it. But maybe that was for you, because I think that's a miracle when that happens.
Well, okay. So fun story. That was when I was finishing up my master's thesis piece. That was actually a different piece. And then Smackety Bang was for like an internal competition in the school. And I told myself I couldn't start writing that until I finished my master's thesis piece, which I was just laboring over. Like I spent at one point, I think, 3 days on the climactic three measures. And it turned out great. Like I'm very happy with that piece as well. And then basically told myself, if I finish this on time, I can go write this other piece. So I actually wrote Smackety Bang pretty quickly. And then it was great. So that happens every once in a while. But as far as the creative process goes, that like it was, I was already in a really good space creatively from having been like steadily working on a bigger piece. And then I was done with that. So I probably got a big rush of brain chemicals from that. And then I just dove in and did basically nothing else for a couple of weeks and wrote Smackety Bang. Based on some, I had some previous notes. It wasn't like completely new, but it was mostly just getting it done by the deadline. And when that happens, which for me is, you can't force that to happen, right? Sometimes something just comes out well. I set the stage for it and it came out, but you can't really force that to happen. Because I've had other periods of time where I've done the same process and haven't been as happy with the result.
Yeah, I mean, no one knows that magic confluence. And you perform your own work, you're a singer, you compose for voice, violin, and piano. And I don't know actually all the instruments that you compose for. I know you compose for film as well. Is there always, I suppose we can't avoid there being some kind of autobiographical element. You could tell me about different works, like if they come from just searching for a sense of beauty and harmony.
The string quartet, Lightlessness, that originated in an incorrect bipolar diagnosis for a long time, which is really common for autistic, not men. And that piece originated in thinking about that. So I was thinking about like depression and mania around but the original version of that string quartet when I was first writing it. And then it, you know, became something else. But that was definitely touching on those experiences. Smackety Bang Bang, I would say it's not autobiographical, but part of what I love about music and part of what I get out of composing and performing and just being involved with it is this very like internal stimming is the word that comes to mind. But for me, some of what I write is about that. It's about the sort of physical enjoyment of the work itself and the way that it comes across. And there's a piece that I do have a recording of, but I don't think it's up anywhere, that was part of a triptych that was commissioned on domestic violence. So that was about elements of my childhood, basically. And that piece, when it was the first version of it was premiered, one of my friends who was there, she said she had leaned forward in her chair to get something. And then the piece started and she felt like she couldn't move. So she just stayed there hunched over for like 5 minutes. And I was like, yeah, that sounds about what I was going for. So I feel like a lot of, I mentioned like three kind of broad things there, right? There's like kind of the autobiographical, there's the me enjoying the stimmy internal thing. And then there's this combo of the two where I'm trying to make someone else have a physical experience that mirrors my own, if that makes sense. So it's not just about their emotional experience. It's that I'm trying to communicate a specific emotional experience. And funnily enough, film has actually been the easiest way to do that. I feel like that's where it's been the most effective. But that piece that I just mentioned, that one about the domestic violence, like that, being able to have that effect, I was like, oh, wow, this is really the power of music to communicate. Because that piece didn't have text. It was just the musical element. So being able to, you know, not that I want to make people anxious, but that was kind of the point of that piece. It was like, this is what this feels like as an observer.
It's so interesting with, and I can't say that I have any deep knowledge of classical music, except for the guests that we have on our show. But it is interesting in that when it's without words, it can be like, as you say, an embodied experience in terms that, you know, whether it's born on voice and we take it the breath and that passes on. But it can also be this transcendent experience, as I understand, where it's disembodied, where for those who have really fixed or rigid, you think in the binary or don't, a very fixed relationship to the gender they were born into, can become somebody else. Like I think, you know, you listen to music, you can feel, you don't feel bound by this body.
That transcendent experience side of it was one of the other things that I feel like really was a lifeline for me, especially in college. I was in a really lovely touring choir in college. And I think there's something really special about singing with people. And I want there to be more of it and more like amateur, you know, like I miss, well, I don't miss it because I wasn't alive for it. But, you know, like societally, every culture had singing together as a thing. And I think it's really interesting that we've really pulled that out into there are people who are good at this and people who are bad at this. And that's kind of true across the arts, right? We're like, by the age of 10 or 11, or we all are like, oh, I'm good about it, drawing or music or whatever, as opposed to this is a beautiful community-based way of expressing yourself that we all have access to. And some communities are better at that than others. You mentioned music education, right, or arts education being so important. And that's part of it, I think, is that access to these transcendent experiences.
Yeah, indeed. We've become so professionalized, and I think we're all walled off in our silos. As much as we say these words about multidisciplinary or whatever, well, we are in our project multidisciplinary, but a lot of people are just like, I can't achieve that because I'm not this. I don't have this degree behind my name, but I'm sentimental or nostalgic for that time when there was more a communal artistic experience, which was one didn't feel remote from. In that way, it's interesting because I have mixed feelings, and I think that you probably, as a neurodivergent person, have mixed feelings about social media, but it has democratized a lot of access, but also kind of weighs us down with all the other problems with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just talking to somebody about this yesterday because I'm planning to actually delete my Facebook and then I'll be done with Meta. I've been on Facebook for 20 years, which is nuts. And part of what I was saying was just that I would rather pay a little bit for social media and not be the product, like just to have a social media platform that's just good and that just gives me what I want without targeting a bunch of ads at me and then selling my data to other people. That side of it, I think the other piece of that, I don't know, I think about this a lot, like how are we actually connecting and is that meaningful and does it actually feel good? And I think we all get some of both, like some aspects of social media and the way that we interact online feel great and connected. And I'm like, yay, I get to keep track of all these friends from college that I wouldn't otherwise, for example. And then at the same time, there's all this data around Instagram knowing that it was making teen girls suicidal and that there were a number of deaths and they didn't do anything about it because that was internal data that they chose not to act on. And they sort of got in trouble for that, but not really. And they're, I don't know, it's a big complicated mess, basically. But to me, a lot of it just comes down to what are we prioritizing as a society? And I don't understand why anyone would think that shareholders are more important than workers or people.
And on that, and I don't want to get too far away from your core creative process and what your work as a healer as well. But I wondered what with the advent of AI, because that's social media on steroids and personalized, you know, you've heard that. I think they had to pull it down, the ChatGPT 4.0 version, because it was too personalized. It was like Scarlett Johansson's voice, whatever. So this is like getting into our brains, if we're buying into it, like that personal helper that can advise you on whatever you want. But I wonder, as an artist and also as someone who is neurodivergent, what is that experience of like going into AI, or what are your reflections on what that's doing to creativity or the homogenization of the arts? I mean, it's a dark area with some positives.
Yeah, well, homogenization is a larger issue as well, and just in terms of connectivity. And I think about this a lot. This is a specific music thing, but how auto-tuned elements of music are that don't even make sense, like tuning the bass drum to the chord, which some producers do. And so people who listen to a lot of pop music are so used to this extremely auto-tuned sound that when they hear the live version of the song, they hate it because that's not what instruments sound like. We're having this like very strange filter that we're getting a lot of things through. And on the AI front, I mean, I'm not worried about it from my own perspective, because part of what I do and what I offer, for example, to a film director is I can make people feel things. So AI can imitate music that has made people feel things, but in terms of being able to line it up with exactly what's happening on screen and have the moment land, that's something that I think a human does really well. And an AI may be able to at some point. This is not my idea at all. This is like a meme at this point, but I wish the AI were taking care of my email and my chores so that humans could make art and not the other way around. It really doesn't make sense to have the AIs making the art and just have humans stuck where they are. Like, I don't get it.
And being the janitor for the AI ideas that were scraped off of living artists that might not have been compensated or dead artists as well. Like they steal from everyone. But it can be sometimes interesting. On that note, I find some of that auto-tuned music very hard to listen to. It's just a little bit wrong. Or the art is just interesting, but it's a little bit wrong. And I actually had
Uncanny Valley for your ears.
Yeah, but I actually had a physical experience where I had a very long Uber ride and I was too polite to say, please turn that artificial music off, which after a long ride, I should have said, but it made me sick. And I wonder what that's like. Your sensitivity must be much greater than my uneducated ear.
And I have literal sensory sensitivity, right? That's part of the neurodivergent profile that I have. My therapist just had me take a sensory sensitivity test recently, like an official one, and I was in the 98th or 99th percentile in every single category. So I'm just extremely sensitive on every front. And as an artist, that's not bad, right? I take in a lot of detailed information and my brain's constantly working with it, but it can be really hard to kind of fit into normal society if you're like that. And then if you're also an artist, and composers are who I know best historically, a lot had chronic illness. And they were just like, well, I can't go outside. I'm stuck in bed for a while. So I guess I'll sit and write. And a lot of authors as well, like writers as well have, and poets in particular, I think have a history of chronic illness, mental illness, and just being stuck at home basically. And like, well, I guess I'll write.
And on that note of sensitivity and illness, I know that you have this sensitivity where you can then also have a high pain threshold because maybe you've gone used to being able to turn it off. Like normally it would be like so high.
Like dissociating out of it. Yeah.
So that you recently had like a near death experience or you?
Yeah, I had a kidney infection that I didn't realize like how sick I was until it was really bad. And by the time I got into the ER, I had most of the signs of sepsis. So that was a case. I was in pain, but I probably should have been feeling a lot more pain. And yeah, I think that's part of my body's defense mechanism of just dissociating away from uncomfortable sensations.
So at that point, because I think we can understand whether we're artists or we have something that we care about, like almost more than ourselves, or we're working as you do as a healer and helping people find their voice or come to a greater sense of balance, that you're so concerned on these projects, you forget about yourself. So in those moments, like there's an opportunity to say, what's important to me? What do I really value? So in that moment, what were you asking yourself?
I did think through that after the last month. So it was very recent and realizing, oh, wow, I really got way closer to death than I should have. That was not good. Part of what I've been thinking about is actually the kind of music business side of it, because a lot of what I've written has been commissions. And that's great. You get paid to write. And that period, say in 2021, where I had 5 classical premieres in 1 year, I like some of the pieces. It's not that I don't like them, but when you're writing for a commission and for a deadline and for someone else's idea of what they want, it's not necessarily what I would be writing if I was just sitting at my piano by myself. So a lot of what I've been thinking about in the last few weeks is just, where am I putting my energy? And these are really broad questions, but what is that doing? Like, what is it doing, the things that I'm putting out in the world? And on the whole, I would rather write or maybe rather produce and put out into the world fewer pieces of music that are really saying what I want them to say, as opposed to just churning out commissions and having a bigger body of work. We touched on this before we started recording that I'm bad at promoting my work. So I have a bunch of stuff that's not online or on someone else's YouTube and not mine or whatever. But yeah, that's a lot of what I've been thinking about in the last month, is just, how do I want to spend my energy, knowing that if all goes well, I'm 36, I'll live a good long time. I've got like a long time to write. And if I could produce a handful of pieces that I was really, really happy with, I think that would be a good output. I think Verez only published 12 pieces.
Oh, yes. And that they resonate. And so one of these pieces that you referred to, a recent piece, fairly recent, is Inexorable.
Yeah. So that was a commission. And that's viola and percussion, which are two of, but I love writing for strings. I love percussion. It's just so fun to write for. There's so many options. So and I was working directly with the performers, we were able to have conversations about if there were any extended technique or particular things they like really wanted to do or, you know, wanted more of. And that piece, I did a video for. It's funny, I look at it and I'm like, I can't tell if this is good. I'm not a video person. But the idea that I had, it's this plant that was on my windowsill that when I would water, it would poof way up and then it would like, it probably needed to be repotted now, you know, in retrospect. But I have this long video. I took a couple of videos that I layered over each other of it going up and down slowly. And this was, I knew I was autistic at this point, but it was funny because part of what I was thinking as I was creating this strange little, and there's poetry. So I was working with a poet that I've worked with before for a choral piece. And that's just like superimposed on the screen. And I look at this and I'm like, is this a good video? Like probably objectively not, but it is expressing something about what I was trying to say about the piece. And that's another thing I think about a lot is the split between good or great art and what makes that versus, not that this is an actual dichotomy, but versus expressing yourself or kind of saying something and then having that actually communicate to the audience. So having the audience have that experience. And for me, part of what that piece did with the video, the text, and then obviously the music, which is what I spent the most time on, is that I think between those three things, you can really get what I was going for. The text is also intense and dark in a way. And then you've just got this image of some flowers just going up and down, basically. And it was the poet was like, does this actually work? I was like, look, I don't know. This is another thing is like when you're working for deadlines and commissions, you're just like, well, the thing needs to be done. It's being premiered. I gotta be done. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And in this case, I like the way it came together. But it's really hard for me to judge my own work, honestly. Sometimes I can tell. I'm like, yes, this is this. But that's more like when I was saying this does what I'm trying to get it to do, or like it has the effect I'm trying to get it to have. I can tell when I do that. But it's harder for me to judge quality on a larger scale. If that makes sense. I think it's very hard from the inside.
I've really been enjoying checking out your work, and I especially enjoyed your piece, Revolutions. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about the quality versus quantity element you're talking about, the business side of things. And I'm curious how that intersects with your neurodivergence and the kind of multidisciplinary aspect of things. Do you feel your process as a composer and a poet and working on things like film score is informed by that? And if so, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. One of the periods in which I wrote a lot in that sort of like 2020 to 2021 period, it was in part because I had commissions or deadlines, like reasons to get things done. I have a second string quartet that I worked on a lot, and three of the four movements are pretty done. But the third movement, I just keep being like, nah, that's a different piece, and pulling it and writing a new one. I did that for a long time. And that's a case where, you know, nobody was making me finish it. I set it aside. I'm not actively working on it right now, but every once in a while, I'm like, oh yeah, that was a good piece. I should try to finish that. The things that I work on my own, it's very hard to make myself finish them if I don't have. And that's just the neurodivergence thing. Like you said, like it's, I can get 95% of the way done and then I have to be interested in it, basically. If the interest isn't there, or if I stop liking the piece, or in the case of that string quartet where I just sort of set it aside, I would need to dedicate time. And that's the other, for me at least, I need big chunks of time to finish a piece. I need to carve out time. And theoretically, I have the freedom to do that because I run my own schedule and I'm a, you know, small business person. Like I can, but do I carve out 2 weeks to 2 months to actually finish something? And then the other piece, that the music business piece of getting it out there, the recording is so important, especially for the premiere. So having a great recording of a piece makes a really big difference in terms of getting it re-performed and being able to send it out. And then just, you know, having people listen to it and interact with it. So if it's not being performed, if it's not being selected or asked for by an ensemble, you basically pay to get it recorded, which I've done a little bit of. But on the whole, it's a lot easier to just go through the traditional channels. And I do have one, it's not set, so I'm not going to talk about it a lot, but I do have one potential big project that I might be working on starting later this year. I still don't know if it's going to work out, but if it does, that'll be like by far the biggest thing that I've done. And it'll take a long time and I'll need to carve out a lot of time for it. And that's basically what we're talking about right now is like, does the time and the money make sense? Because I'm going to need to take months off of work to just do this. And if I were independently wealthy, which a lot of composers are, just like have family money, that would be, I would just do that. And so I have made peace with writing fewer total pieces or producing fewer total pieces. I think the writing is very important. It's important to have a lot of writing that you don't put out there that's like not good, I think. So it's not about not writing, but like in terms of finishing pieces and putting them out there. Yeah, that the neurodivergence and the music business side of it do kind of butt heads a little bit.
And to bring that around to some of the work that you're doing with others, your Love Your Brain course is such a fascinating combination of so many interdisciplinary sections. And I was curious about how that started and what have you learned through taking other people through this process of healing that you clearly went yourself with music?
Yeah, thank you. That course, because people listening don't know, is basically the idea was, and again, a lot of what I've made has been, I was looking for something similar few years ago, couldn't find it, and then eventually created it myself. Like by the time I figured out how to do it myself. And the idea is for kind of mid-career artists and creatives in general who are neurodivergent and in particular autistic and or ADHD, there's really not a lot out there. A lot of the advice out there about how to finish projects, I was describing like the last 5% just being just torture. Like it's off. I'm just trying to dragging myself through the boring parts. But I've figured out ways to do that are not harmful to my body or my brain and that are like repeatable, sustainable. So that's the goal with that is to help people come up with their own process, not just do what I did. Cause that's a lot of the advice out there is basically like, I did this thing and it works for me and here are all the steps. And it's like, well, actually not only did every neurodivergent brain develop differently, but also every artist and their or creative, their process is so different and they need different things. They need different chunks of time. They need different supports. All these things around it. So that's the idea there is to kind of build your process and then to have support around it that's specifically for ADHD brain. That's what that was. Yeah.
I want to go back to that thing about having the time for the art to expand. And, you know, sometimes it just needs to settle, right? And sometimes a work of art or even on the level of coaching, sometimes are the problems that we have or the challenges that we face, they're small things that can be sorted out by our unconscious. And so what are the way, I mean, I can't have you condense your Love Your Brain course or the many conversations that you've had on the ADHD Flourishing podcast, but how do you make that time or how do you come to a good place with, how you say, a relationship with your unconscious that it can solve some of these things that perplex us?
Amazing, huge question. For me, a lot of the way I think about it these days is removing a lot of the stuff that's in the way. So I feel like we waste a lot of energy. I mean, shame is a word that comes to mind, like neurodivergent kids. I think if there was a study about ADHD kids, if I'm remembering correctly, it's they in school, they were getting 17 pieces of negative verbal feedback for every one piece of positive that they got. So ADHD kids are just growing up being told no all the time, just this very negative frame on their actions. And so we have this internalized shame of like, I'm doing it wrong. I just frequently had this feeling that I was just always doing the wrong thing. I never felt like I was, and it's not just anxiety. I've had these actual messages from people saying, oh, you're doing this thing. No, you should be doing this over here, or you're doing it wrong. Or anyway, that's like its own thing. So for me, just removing a lot of the shame and then a lot of the energy that I was wasting trying to fit myself into a neurotypical process or framework or way of thinking or being. Some people call that unmasking, just kind of removing. I was wasting a lot of energy basically trying to be someone else and function in a different way and then just beating myself up internally for not being able to do that. And throughout my healing journey, as I really realized, oh, that's actually what's happening. Like there's not actually anything wrong with me. And it's why it's called Love Your Brain. It's not just, you know, tolerate your brain or fine, you can work with this brain that you have. I genuinely love the weird experiences that my brain can give me. And the incredibly rich, deep experience I have of the world. And I experience nature so deeply and so intensely. I have really strong connections with animals. I have really great intuition, which I think is just from picking up all this sensory data and putting it together. All these experiences that I get to have, but I don't get to have those experiences if I'm just trying to make myself be something else, which I think is most people who are late diagnosed. I feel like that's their experience. I've been trying to be someone else for so long. It's exhausting. And then you don't have the energy then to be creative because then in carving out the time, making the time to actually create, for me as an incredibly monotropic person, I need big chunks of time to not have demands placed on me. When I say I need a few weeks or a few months for something, it's not because I'm working 9 to 5 on the project, right? It's not, I'm not working. I didn't just turn my art into an office job. It's that I will have some days where I'm focused on the work from early in the morning until late at night. And then I'll have some days where I'm just walking my friend's dog and sitting at the park and like doing other stuff. But like the unconscious process in the background is happening. I know you were mentioning that also like in a healing context, but then there's also obviously the creative process where boredom is integral to the creative process. We need that time of just sitting and being and taking things in. And for me, like feeling connected. So being in nature, there's this element of even just why am I creating the work? Like, why am I making the time? And for me, it is that connective, communicative. I'm either expressing myself and or I'm trying to communicate something. Otherwise, why would I make a big piece of art? I don't know, probably other reasons, but that's how I think of it.
As you've just heard Mattia describe, the tension between our modern expectations of what an artist should produce and the often inconvenient reality of the creative process is an essential feature of many musicians' and composers' lives. Adding in the many societal pressures put on neurodivergent people to conform to a system that often produces negative results, even for the most neurotypical among us, and you've got a complicated and messy situation. If we become so focused on the monetization and creation of arbitrary, attention-grabbing content instead of meaningful creative output, then we've lost something vital, and it's important that composers like Mattia provide a counterbalance to the endless churn of our capitalist societies. In fact, if we were to put some of our most beloved composers of the past in a modern setting, would they be able to cope? Take Mozart, for instance. Though we know him today for his over 600-piece body of work, historical records also indicate that he may have been on the autism spectrum, suffered from OCD, or even Tourette's. The space, solitude, and ultimately boredom that is needed for a successful gestation of a truly moving musical composition is something rarely found these days. In fact, it is often discouraged. And artists are now required by their circumstances to either dilute their creative goals, spend much less time creating, or simply abandon the project altogether. As Mattia has already mentioned, creativity for people without generational wealth or another kind of societal support net can be a Herculean task. And furthermore, this conformity and pressure uniquely put on folks in this position could be one of the greatest threats to free and authentic musical expression. If we wish to foster a future generation of artists whose pieces resonate as deeply as Mozart's, then we are obligated to once again create that space and support for people whose creative stirrings and life experiences fall outside of the norm. Because no matter how much we pretend to devalue art, if we lose our artists and creatives, we lose the lifeblood, inspiration, and ultimately joy of our society. And a joyless society is not one worth living in. Now, back to the interview.
Getting back to that core reason for being, and not just because I have to do it. Like, it's not just a commissions, of course, I can have this great impetus, particularly when it's a group, but it's, what does this say about me, the time I live in, or my feeling for the natural world? But tell me a little bit about that, because do you experience colors more intensely, maybe the sounds, just to go into those specific experiences that everyone might not have?
Yes, I do, as far as I can tell, experience everything very intensely. I am frequently, this is my joke, is I'm always pointing at smells and people are like, what are you pointing at? And I'm like, oh, right, you're not smelling that. So yes, I have a very intense experience of a lot of, I don't know, just everything. All my sensory things are heightened. I was on a retreat where the only time I've done a full dose of psychedelics. And the day that we did that, and it was beautiful. It was in Costa Rica. And so we were in the jungle. And there's these huge blue butterflies, like all these beautiful things. And I kept pointing out little animals that we were seeing. And somebody was like, oh, you're noticing this because this heightens our... I was like, no, this is my normal experience. The psychedelic actually did not enhance my sensory experience at all. And for everybody else, it did. So that was really interesting to go, oh, my daily experience is what some people are getting on psychedelics. Like, that's just my constant baseline. But what that did, that what that experience did was I wasn't able to dial them down. So I couldn't dissociate out or focus on one at once. It was like all the sensory stuff was just on full force. And I was like, wow, this is what my brain is like when I don't actively try to dial it back or focus. It's just this huge, overwhelming, but also really lovely because of the setting and all of that. And that was actually like, that was a deeply healing experience for me as well to just go, oh, I'm actually dealing with a lot more all the time. And look at how much support these folks need to have my daily experience. Like, they need to be led around and fed and, like, you know, which I sometimes do as well. But it was really interesting to get that really direct feedback about how intense my experience is compared to a lot of other people's.
Yeah, it's so interesting. So you don't need the drugs because you gain something when you have a portal or a doorway into another reality. And I was interested in the process of when you transitioned, you also took drugs and had that changed your voice as well. You know, it takes a lot of courage, but also the fact that your voice transformed. Maybe just describe that for listeners, because then creatively, like you were interested in what you gained, but how do you hold on to the other elements that you also was part of your voice, your biography, your whole life?
Yeah, if I wasn't trans, I probably just would have been a vocalist like that. I would have gone for a master's in that. But I was a very high soprano. I didn't like hearing myself. It was this weird thing where I understood that my voice was good. The thing that stands out to me is after one performance at this gala I performed at when I was doing that more, somebody I knew came up to me afterwards and was like, if I had your voice, I wouldn't consider doing anything else with my life. And I was like, cool, I don't like it. I'm not having a good time. So, you know, it's being trans like that, just internal experience. It was so dysphoric for me. And when I came out initially as genderqueer, I started pitching my voice down as much as I could, which wasn't very much. But actually, I just found a video the other day from before I started pitching my voice down. I was like, I literally sound like a child. My voice is so high pitched. And anyway, as I just didn't attach to it very much, but I found it very easy to sing and perform. Like singing was always very easy. And I plowed through a lot of the initial repertoire very quickly. Probably also from having a string background, having a good ear, et cetera. And then now I actually have to work. I actually have to practice and work hard with my voice because it's completely different. My speaking voice is, I think, more than an octave lower than it was before. So there's this very different mechanism. I have to work with it differently. I think about it. It takes a lot more thought and work and intention to sing now. And I'm so much happier with the way it sounds, and it just feels more like me. So I feel much more happy and connected with my voice, even though in some objective sense, it's probably not as good, or like my range isn't as big, or like my functional range isn't as big as it was, but I'm so much happier with it. I don't care. Like when my mom asked me why I went for composition instead of voice, I sent her a video of a parrot doing the Queen of the Night aria. I was like, I don't want to stand on stage and sing ah for 7 minutes. Like, it's great. And my friends who are operatic sopranos, I'm like, you're amazing. I love that for you, but I was just not happy with my voice. So I guess the part that's carried through to answer that question is just the love of singing itself. Like it's fun. I know it feels good. It's a very embodied experience, but my actual voice is very different.
It's so interesting that because there's singers who don't have the full range, but they have that emotional range, right? That goes deep in and sometimes limiting the functional range can tap into that deeper something in us listeners. So it's funny that you could trade that. So it's interesting that by limiting your functional range, you had access to that deeper emotional range, which was really about your story rather than sharing other people's stories. Interpreting.
Yeah. And the way it felt was I was singing correctly before. I was like doing classical technique correctly. And now I feel like I have access to that emotional quality, essentially, and not just trying to sound correct, but having this like direct feedback loop between my emotions and my voice. I didn't really have that before. So yeah, that's been a really lovely experience.
And what is your advice? I understand that you came to be a coach. It came from being a teacher of music, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting. So what would you found that people were coming with you were coming for lessons, but they were leaving with something else besides.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, really that was happening. Voice students were asking me kind of life questions, problems, et cetera. And then one of my sisters actually went and did a coaching certification and she was describing to me what she was doing. And I was like, I'm doing that. That is some of the time. And then once I started working pretty exclusively with neurodivergent folks, that especially the ADHD stuff where it's so hard to find anything about, for me, that's been really meaningful to be able to help folks. And I don't know that I'll do that it's not my like lifelong career thing, but for right now, I feel like being able to fill that gap where it's just really hard to find stuff. I frequently, when I work with people, they're like, I've tried everything. I don't understand why my problems don't seem that difficult, but nobody can help me. And then I'm like, oh, have you thought about this? Like, no, I've just literally never thought about that because nobody's ever suggested it before. But to me, it seems obvious, again, from the inside of the ADHD experience. So yeah, that's become a big part of what I do. And speaking of time, that's the main way I make money these days. And I really enjoy it. I actually don't teach music lessons. I taught for 20 years and then I was just like, I'm ready to take a break. So I haven't been teaching private lessons. But the thing that I did make a year or two ago that I'm very proud of, studio.com asked me to make a course about composition. And I can share that with you if you want to share it with folks. But it's basically, it's observing my process. So it's not just me lecturing about composition. It's me showing how I'm writing a piece, which I thought was a really cool approach. And then because I don't teach privately anymore, that's like the best way to access my compositional brain and learn how I think about things, how I approach things. But then also, like, one of the things I did and that I thought was really fun is show, here's how you like steal from classical music scores to deal with that blank page problem. If you're just like, I just need to get started. It's like, here's how you can pull an element of form, make your own scale and like layer that over this other melody. So it doesn't sound like that at all. It's just taking the gestural shapes or something. And your end product would be totally, completely different. Nobody else would probably notice the connection. But I think about that a lot too, in terms of a compressed timeline or like trying to make something for a deadline, is it can be really intimidating to start from the blank page, especially if you're trying to do something or say something meaningful to you. You know, a lot of my pieces do have a personal meaning or a political meaning, or they're saying something. And I think that that desire to then make it really, really good can get people stuck. So anyway, that's part of what that course is about.
Well, I was also wondering, is it ever possible to, I mean, I'm a person that's curious about I think we all are, how our minds work, you know, where what our ideas come from, even if it's not dealing with past dramas, but is it possible to know too much about the way your mind works that it can get in the way of creativity?
I think the thing that feels like it gets in the way, just again, as I've learned more about other non-autistic brains, is my brain just has a lot of thoughts all the time layered, and there's like multiple layers of music going on. I can hear a piece in the background most of the time, and then sometimes my brain will start doing other stuff with that, or like layer two audio tracks with like multiple voices speaking in my head all the time. There's just this like constant noise, essentially, unless I'm, well, Adderall does help me personally with that, the noise level internally. But I think it is really interesting going from just assuming that my experience was the norm to realizing, oh, I'm having this really intense sensory experience. I'm having this ridiculously multi-layered internal audio experience, all this stuff. And there can be something a little bit distracting about that. But I think a lot of what I've come to with it, I mean, again, that kind of cheesy line, love your brain, right? I want to work with what I have because this is it. This is how my brain is. This is how my brain developed. It's not going to become appreciably different, probably, over the course of my life. So I may as well work with it. Sometimes that means that I just need a complete time off to just follow my interests and just ignore everything else. It means I need more time transitioning between things. But yeah, I think that's a great question. Can knowledge of your brain get in the way? Like, absolutely. And also for a lot of folks who are, you know, coming to this later in life, it becomes like a special interest or an area of interest where they're really putting a lot of time in trying to understand it. And if I have a piece of advice around that, it's not everything needs to be explained. Like, it can just be your experience. A lot of my internal experience is also nonverbal. So there's nothing I can really do with that to explain it other than create art. And I don't need to be able to understand or explain it. I can let some of my experience, I guess. I don't know if that's exactly the best way of putting it.
Oh, I think so. Yes, there are some things that don't need to be explained. It's helpful to have a label or labels that show that there's a lot of variety of experiences in this world. But then also, it's nice to have those unspoken artistic experiences that are other pathways for healing and understanding. So finally, I guess, as you think about the future and education, perhaps those teachers or even collaborators or mentors that have been important for you and the importance of the arts, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Oh, wow. Yes, teachers have been really big in my life. And a couple of my collaborators as well have really shaped my understanding of the world. The one who did the poetry for Inexorable, and we have another choral piece that will hopefully be performed later this year. He's from South Africa and he's older than me. So he's had this experience of living under apartheid. So learning about his life experiences really opened my eyes to a lot of global issues in the world that, you know, maybe knew about but didn't have any emotional connection to. And then one of my other long-term collaborators, Pompey, is a dancer, and they spent their young childhood in India. So again, just a very different cultural experience. And they've been my two closest collaborators for many years. So hugely important. And then obviously teachers, right? Like my teacher in grad school, Malcolm Payton, he was, I think, 83 when we started working together. So he had a huge, you know, life experience to bring to that. And for me, was a great teacher. Didn't help me with the business side, but that's okay. Made me a much better composer. Advice? One of the things I think about a lot is this. I so vividly remember the desire throughout pretty much most of my 20s and certainly my teen years to basically be a famous artist, win big awards. And when you dig down into what you actually want from that, it's connection. And especially like the teen brain in particular is extremely geared toward connection and is getting different brain chemical payouts for different things than adults are. So certainly when I think of like teenagers, I think of that drive for connection and fitting in and being accepted is so strong. And that was a part of my artistic output or desire as well. It was like, okay, if I write something world-changing, like then I'll be a really well-regarded composer and get that respect. Or if I go more the songwriting and film route, I can be beloved or have people love my music and have this emotional experience with my music. There were all these dreams that I had that I think largely boiled down to just wanting to be accepted. And you can get that outside of your career and outside of the arts. So yes, it's great, obviously, if I do end up making something world-changing, but I don't expect that. And you never know that that's going to happen. And if that were still my goal, I would be very frustrated with my life right now. But as it is, I've been able to kind of cobble together these various artistic things and do a little bit of things here and there, move in and out of projects. But because I'm not trying to be famous, essentially, or just get all of my emotional needs met through my career or my artistic output, I've been able to be a lot more chill about letting things happen and taking opportunities that are fun, but maybe not high paid or whatever. There's all these things that feed into that. So I know that's kind of wide ranging, but the advice of we're seeking connection and you can find that in a lot of ways. And trying to meld that with the way you make money is very, very, very challenging, especially in this particular economic moment, I feel.
Yes. And it's only getting more difficult.
Exactly.
AI and all the new developments that are supposed to be tools, but may come between artists and their fulfillment of, you know, basic sustenance. But I think that what you say is so important. And that also that we're always just finding out who we are. It's evolving all the time. And some people don't, when you talk about young people, we don't know who we are when we're just teenagers. We're just changing. Our brains are changing. Everything's changing. And sometimes people don't even discover who they are until their 40s, 50s, or even by the time that they retire and they're too old, they don't give that time for themselves. So what you do is very important, and to emphasize to give that time for connecting with our creative selves and just finding that sense of community. It's been very interesting listening to you. So thank you, Mattia Morey, for inviting us into your imaginative world, sharing your creative journey and helping others find their voices to create pathways for balance and well-being. Thank you for adding your voice to the creative process.
Thank you so much.
The Creative Process Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. The interview was conducted by Mia Funk and Lyle Hutchins with the participation of collaborating universities and students. The associate interview producers on this episode were Katie Foster and Lyle Hutchins. Associate text editor was Nadia Lam. The creative process is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Wintertime was composed by Nicholas Anadolis and performed by the Athenian Trio. We hope you enjoy listening to this podcast. If you'd like to get involved with our creative community exhibitions, podcasts, or submit your creative works for review, just drop us a line at team@creativeprocess.info. Thanks for listening.